home to over 140,000 Palestinian refugees, one of the most deprived and radical square miles on Earth. The subject of her talk was the humanitarian crisis in the camp, and a grand total of 10 people showed up. But she was so accustomed to swimming against the tide of international indifference, it didn't worry her. One day, somebody would hear, and that person would change everything. It was a brutally hot night, and in the midst of her address, she paused and took off her half veil.
"There are so few of us, I feel like I'm among family," she said, smiling.
None of the tiny audience objected, and even if the Saracen had been inclined to do so, it took him long enough to recover from the sight of her face that the opportunity was lost. With only her serious voice to go by, he had drawn up a mental picture of her that was completely at variance with her large eyes, expressive mouth, and flawless skin. Her tightly pulled back hair lent her a boyish quality, and while individually her features were far too irregular to be considered attractive, when she smiled, everything seemed to coalesce, and nobody could have ever convinced the Saracen that she wasn't beautiful. Although she was about 5 years his senior, there was something, the shape of her eyes, her hunger for life, that reminded him of the elder of his sisters. He hadn't had any contact with his family since the day he had left Bahrain, and a sharp wave of homesickness suddenly hit him. By the time he had ridden it out, the woman was saying something about the near enemies.
"I'm sorry," he said. "Could you repeat that?"
She turned her large eyes on the self-possessed young man, the one somebody had told her was a deeply devout medical student, but who she guessed from the weather-beaten face was almost certainly a returned jihad warrior. She knew the type. The Jabalia camp was full of Muj veterans. Addressing him with the great respect he deserved, she said that nearly all the Arab world's problems were caused by what could be called their near enemies. Israel, of course. The ruthless dictatorships scattered throughout the region. The corrupt feudal monarchies like Saudi Arabia who were in the pocket of the West.
"I hear all the time that if our near enemies are destroyed, then most of the problems would be solved. I don't think it's possible. The near enemies are too ruthless, too happy to oppress and kill us. But they only survive and prosper because they are supported by the far enemy. A few forward thinkers, wise people, say that if you can defeat the far enemy, all the near enemies will collapse."
"That's what I like about theories," the medical student replied. "They always work. It's different if you have to try to implement them. Is it even possible to destroy a country as powerful as America?"
She smiled.
"As I'm sure you know, the jihadists broke the back of an equally powerful nation in Afghanistan."
The Saracen walked the 5 miles home in turmoil. He had never had a clear idea of how to bring down the House of Saud, and he had to admit there was a reason why all Saudi dissidents were based overseas. Those who lived or traveled inside its borders were invariably informed upon and eliminated. Look at what had happened to his father. But never to enter the country and yet force the collapse of the Saudi monarchy by inflicting a grievous wound on the far enemy? Well, that was a different proposition. By the time he turned into the doorway of his tiny apartment, he knew the way forward. While he might still become a doctor, he wasn't going back to Saudi Arabia. Again, he didn't know how to do it yet. Allah would show him when the time was right. But he was going to take the battle to the one place which loomed larger than any other in the collective Arab imagination. It would take years. On occasion, the hurdles would seem insurmountable. But his long journey to mass murder had begun. He was going to strike at the heart of America. Chapter 8. 10 years after the Saracen's revelation and half a world away, I was on a sidewalk in Paris arguing with a stranger, a black guy with a limp. Lieutenant Bradley would end up holding my life in his hands, but in the short term, I was silently cursing him to hell. In telling me that he wanted to discuss my book, he had comprehensively destroyed all the layers of false identities I had so carefully constructed around myself. Seemingly unaware of the detonation he had caused, he was now explaining that an hour earlier He had arrived outside my apartment just in time to see a person who he thought was me get into a cab. He had grabbed his own taxi, followed me to the Place de la Madeleine, circled the block trying to find me, and, when that failed, had returned to the apartment to pick up the trail. It was he who had knocked on the door and, not sure whether I was inside or not, had decided to wait in the street to see if I turned up. I got the sense he thought this was all pretty amusing, and I started to dislike him even more. As much as I wanted to blow him off, I couldn't. I was scared. He'd found me, and if he could do it, so might someone else. The Greeks, for instance. Everything, my feelings included, had to be set aside until I found out how he had done it. "Fancy a coffee?" I said pleasantly. "Yeah, he'd like that," he said, volunteering to pay. That was a mistake. Given the part of Paris we were standing in, he'd probably have to cash in his pension plan for an espresso and an eclair, but I wasn't in the mood to show any mercy. We started walking down Rue François Première, a few paces apart, in silence. But we hadn't gone more than 5 yards before I had to stop. Bradley was gamely trying to keep up, but the limp on his right leg was worse than I had realized. "Birth defect?" I asked. "I can be fairly unpleasant when I'm angry."
"That's the other leg," he shot back. "I got this one last year."
"Work or sport?" I was having to walk with him, so it seemed unreasonable not to continue the conversation.
"Work."
He paused fractionally.
"Lower Manhattan. Ran into a building without thinking. It wasn't the first time I'd done it, but this one was different. Lucky it didn't kill me."
It was clear from his tone he didn't want to elaborate on the circumstances.
"Looks like your hip," I said,
as we continued even more slowly, pretty sure I was right from the way he was rolling and what I remembered of my medical training.
"They replaced it with titanium and plastic. Said I'd need a lot of physio, but shit, not 8 months.
A homicide cop, a destroyed hip, titanium pins to hold the bone together. Sounded like a large-caliber gunshot wound to me. He didn't volunteer anything else, and I have to say that, despite myself, I was warming to him. There's nothing worse than cops with war stories. Except maybe spooks. We stopped at the lights, and I pointed at a limestone hotel with 3 new Rolls-Royce Phantoms parked in front of it. "The Plaza Athénée," I said. "We can get a coffee there."
"Looks expensive,"
he replied, unaware that very soon he would understand the true meaning of that word. We went through the revolving door, across a marble foyer, and into the hotel's grand gallery. From there, tall doors opened onto one of the most beautiful courtyards in Paris. Totally enclosed, overlooked on all sides by bedrooms, its walls were covered in ivy. The balconies set among the greenery were shaded by red awnings, and guests could look down on a concert grand, elaborate topiaries, numerous Russian oligarchs, and a variety of other Eurotrash. We took a table at the back, almost hidden from view, and the battered cop started to explain how he had deconstructed the legend of one of the world's most secret agents. Though he didn't say in so many words, it quickly became apparent that the injuries he had sustained when he ran into the building were far more serious than a smashed hip. One lung had collapsed, another bullet, I guessed, his spine had been injured, and he had sustained a bad blow to his head, all of which added up to 3 weeks in intensive care. For the first week, it was a near-run thing if he'd survive, and Marcy wouldn't leave his side. Somehow, she and the physicians rolled the stone back from the cave, and eventually, he was released to the high-dependency unit. There, it became clear that his ailments were more than physical. Whatever abyss he had looked into meant he barely talked and appeared to feel even less. Maybe it was fear, maybe it was cowardice, maybe there was someone he couldn't save, he never explained, but whatever it was he'd encountered in that building meant he'd left a lot of himself behind.
"I was alive, but I was a shadow of the person who'd gone to work that day," he said quietly. "The numbing, the emotional disconnection was worse than any physical injury. Not just for me, for Marcy."
Not even the love of his wife could turn his face towards the light, and I was certain, though he never used the term, that he was suffering from what was once called shell shock and was now termed post-traumatic stress disorder. After weeks of anti-anxiety drugs but little improvement, the doctor suggested that taking him home might offer the best chance of reconnecting him. They probably needed the bed. Marcy spent 2 days rearranging the apartment, turning a corner of their bedroom into an area for his physiotherapy sessions and filling it with his favorite books, music, and anything else she thought might engage him.
"It didn't work," he added. "I had too much anger and a bad case of what the psychologists call survivor guilt."
For the first time, I realized that others must have died during the incident. A partner, I wondered, a couple of members of his team. In retrospect, I was pretty dumb about the whole situation, but in my defense, I had no time to consider any of it in detail. He was hurrying on. He said that whatever hopes Marcy had of nursing him back to health with love were soon overwhelmed by the terrible toll mental illness can take on even a good relationship. Because he had been injured in the line of duty, she didn't have to worry about his medical bills, and after 3 soul-destroying weeks, she finally got the number of a highly regarded residential care facility in upstate New York. In the bleakest hours, she wondered whether, once her husband had been admitted, he would ever come home again. "I've been to enough Narcotics Anonymous meetings to know it only takes about 20 minutes before somebody gets up and says they had to hit bottom before they could start the long climb out." So it was with Marcy. Sitting up late one evening, she'd begun filling in the form she had received that morning from the Wellness Foundation in Hudson Falls. With Ben asleep in the next room, watching people die over and over in his dreams, and a questionnaire taking her back through so many shared experiences, she found herself deeper in the canyons of despair than she had ever been. She didn't know it, of course, but she had finally found bottom. One question asked what personal items the patient would enjoy having with them. "Nothing, really," she answered. What was the point? She had tried providing all of that. As she was about to continue, she stared at the word, and a strange thought took hold. "Nothing," she said quietly. Marcy was a smart woman, a teacher at a charter high school in New York, and like most women, she had thought a lot about love. She knew, even in marriage, if you advanced too far to please the other person, it let them edge away, and you ended up always laughing and fighting and screwing on their territory. Sometimes you had to stand your ground and make them come to you, just to keep the equilibrium. She turned and looked at the bedroom door. She knew she had done so much to try to restore her husband's mental health that the equilibrium was way out of line. Maybe the trick was to make him emerge from the deep cell he'd built and edge back towards her. When Ben woke 7 hours later from his drug-assisted sleep, he thought he was in the wrong life. This wasn't the bedroom he and Marcy shared. This wasn't the room he had closed his eyes on. Yes, the doors and windows were in the same place, but all the things that individuated it, that made it his and Marcy's space, were gone. There were no photographs, no paintings, and no mess on the floor. The TV had gone, and even the Killam they both loved had silently disappeared. Apart from the bed and some physio equipment, there was, well, nothing. As far as he could see it, it was the white room at the end of the universe. Confused about where he really was, he swung off the bed and, hobbling from his smashed thigh, crossed the room. He opened the door and looked into a parallel universe. His wife was in the kitchen, trying to hurry up her coffee. Bradley watched her in silence. In the 20 years they had been together, she had grown ever more beautiful in his eyes. She was tall and slim, with simply cut hair that accentuated the fine shape of her face, but which, more importantly, seemed to say she didn't care much about her own good looks. That, of course, was the only way to handle such a gift, and it made her appear even more attractive. Looking at her in the midst of the home they loved gave him a terrible catch in his throat. He wondered if he was being shown what he had left behind. Maybe he had never got out of the building and was already dead. Then Marcy realized he was there and smiled at him. Bradley was relieved. He was pretty certain people who saw a dead guy in their bedroom doorway didn't act like that. Not Marcy, anyway, who didn't care much for Halloween and had a deep aversion to graveyards. For the first time in months, Marcy's spirits ticked higher. The new strategy had at least made him come to the cell door and look out.
"Another minute and I'm leaving for work. I'll be back in time to get dinner," she said.
"Work?"
he queried, trying to get his mind around the idea. She hadn't been to work since he was injured. She said nothing. If he wanted answers, he was going to have to work for them. He watched her jam a piece of toast in her mouth, grab her travel cup of coffee, and head out the door with a small wave. It left Bradley marooned in the doorway, so after a moment of silence and unable to keep the weight on his strapped leg, he did the only thing he thought sensible. He left the parallel world and went back into the white room. He lay down, but try as he might, he couldn't think clearly about what was happening with so many psychoactive drugs in his body. In silence, alone in the decaying morning, he decided the only practical thing to do was to wean himself off them. It was a dangerous but crucial decision. At last, he was taking responsibility for his own recovery. Despite her promise, Marcy didn't fix him dinner that night. He was in a fitful sleep, so she decided to leave him be. Instead of a meal tray, she placed a new hardcover book on his bedside table, hoping that, with nothing else to occupy him, he would eventually pick it up. The idea for the book had come to her that morning, and immediately after school she had hurried down to a store near Christopher Street. It was called Zodiac Books, but it had nothing to do with astrology. It was named after a serial killer in Northern California whose exploits had spawned a one maniac publishing industry. Marcy had never been inside Zodiac. She only knew of it from Ben, so when she climbed the set of steep stairs, she was amazed to enter a space as big as a warehouse, stacked with the greatest repository of books about crime, forensic science, and investigation in the world. She explained to the aging owner behind his desk what she was looking for. Technical, factual, something to engage a professional. The owner was 6'7" and looked more like he belonged in the backwoods than in a bookshop. A former FBI profiler, he slowly unfurled himself and led her past shelves coated with dust and into a row of books and periodicals marked New Releases. Some of them must have been 40 years old. From a small carton on the floor, newly arrived from the publisher, he lifted out a buff-colored doorstop of a book.
"You told me he's sick," the Sequoia said,
opening the highly technical material to show her.
50 pages of this should finish him off."
"Seriously," she said, "is it any good?"
He smiled, swept his hand around the room.
"Might as well throw the rest away."
As a result, the book which I had spent so many months writing ended up sitting on Bradley's bedside table. He saw it when he woke early the next morning, but made no move towards it. It was a Saturday, and when Marcy brought his breakfast in, he asked her about it.
"What's it for?"
"I thought you might find it interesting. Look at it, if you want," she said, trying not to put any pressure on him.
He didn't glance at it, turning instead towards his food. Throughout the day, every time she came in to check on him, her disappointment grew. The book hadn't been touched. She didn't know, but Bradley had been in a turmoil of his own since the moment he woke, coming down off the drugs, a jackhammer of a headache splitting his skull as his body adjusted, a kaleidoscope of thoughts all let loose, making him remember when he didn't even want to think. By the time she was fixing dinner, Marcy had given up hope. With no sign of interest in the book from her husband, she found the forms from the Wellness Foundation and started rehearsing how she was going to tell him it would be best if he went back to the hospital. She couldn't come up with any way of spinning it so that it didn't sound like a defeat, and she knew it might shatter him. But she had run out of mental highway, and close to tears, she opened the door into the bedroom and braced herself for the imminent wreck. He was sitting up in bed, 30 pages into my book, sweating hard, face etched with pain. God knows what effort it had taken for him to get that far, but he knew it was important to Marcy. Every time she came in, she couldn't stop her eyes sliding to the book. Marcy stared, frightened she was going to drop the tray, but decided that by even acknowledging the event, she might scare him back into the cell, so she just continued normally.
"It's bullshit," he said.
Oh, God. Her soaring spirits nosedived, ready for another one of his episodes of wild anger.
"I'm sorry, the man in the shop told me," she replied.
"No, not the book, the book's fantastic," he said irritably. "I mean the author. Call it intuition, call it what you like, he's not FBI. I know those guys, they don't work the frontier. This guy is something special."
He motioned her closer, indicating where he'd marked things he had found arresting. And she never remembered seeing any of it, stealing glances at her husband, wondering if his spark of engagement would light a fire, or whether, as with people she had read about who emerged from comas, it would die quickly, and he would sink back into the void. He took the dinner napkin off the tray and used it to wipe the sweat from his face. It gave Marcy a chance to leaf back to the beginning of the book. She stopped at the few lines of biography, but a picture of the author was conspicuous by its absence.
"Who is he, then?" she asked. "Who do you think Jude Garrett really is?"
"No idea. I'm hoping he'll make a mistake and tell us by accident," he said.
All through the weekend, to Marcy's relief, the fire kept blazing. She sat on the bed as he plowed through the pages, reading out slabs to her, arguing ideas back and forth. And as he went deeper, continually thinking about the science of investigation, he was forced to consider the one crime he had tried so hard to forget. Fragments of what had happened in the building kept floating to the surface of his mind, dragging the breath and the sweat out of him. On Sunday night, seemingly out of nowhere, the words overtopped the dam, and he told her that at one point he was trapped in what felt like a concrete tomb, and that it had been so dark he hadn't been able to see the face of the dying man he was with. He started to cry, as he said that all he had been able to do was to try to catch his last words, a message for his wife and two young kids. And for the first time, as her husband cried in her arms, Marcy thought everything might be okay. Slowly, he went back to reading, and Marcy stayed with him every word of the way. Hours later, Bradley said he thought the author was too smart. He wasn't accidentally going to reveal his identity. Jokingly, he told her the test of any great investigator would be to discover who the guy really was. They turned and looked at one another. Without a word, Marcy went into the next room and got her laptop. From that moment on, discovering my identity became their project, their rehabilitation, the renewal of their love story. And for me, it was a disaster. Chapter 9. 19 words. Sitting in the Plaza Athénée, not admitting to anything, I'd asked Bradley what had made him think the author was in Paris, and that's what he told me. Out of a total of 320,000 words in the book, 19 fucking words had given my secret away. 7 of them, he said, were an attempt by the author to describe the different colors of decaying blood. I remembered the passage exactly. I had compared the shades to a particular type of tree I had seen change from bright red to brown every fall of my childhood. So what? Checking every detail, Bradley said he called a professor of botany and asked him about the tree. Apparently, they were unique to the eastern seaboard, and I had unwittingly identified at least the general area where I grew up. The other 12 words, 200 pages later, concerned a murder weapon, the stick used to play lacrosse, something which I said I recognized because I had seen students at my high school with them. Bradley told me that if you call the U.S. Lacrosse Association, you will learn that there are 124 high schools on the eastern seaboard which offer it as a sport. They were getting closer. By then, Marcy had located Garrett's cousin living in New Orleans and learned that the guy's reading extended to 4 letters, ESPN. The cousin said that Garrett had graduated high school in 1986, and Bradley guessed, from 2 references in the book, that the real author was from the same era. He called the 124 high schools, which played lacrosse, and, as an NYPD detective, requested the names of all male students who had graduated between 1982 and 1990, expanding the search just to be on the safe side. Very soon, he had a long list of names, but one which he felt sure included the identity of the real author. Working through it would have been overwhelming, except they were mostly private schools, and they were always looking for donations to increase their endowment. The best source of money was former students, and there were not many databases better than an alumni association with its handout. They had extensive records of all their former pupils, and Bradley combed through pages of lawyers and Wall Street bankers, looking for anything out of the ordinary. He had nothing to show for his trouble until, one night, in the names from a school called Caulfield Academy, he and Marcy came across a person called Scott Murdoch.
"He had graduated high school in 87, Bradley told me, biting into the world's most expensive eclair. "He was accepted to Harvard, studied medicine, and got a doctorate in psychology. A great career lay ahead of him, but then, nothing. The Alumni Association had no address, no work history, no news. From the minute he graduated, they knew less about him than anyone else. He had simply disappeared. Of everyone we looked at, he was the only one like that."
He glanced up to see what I was thinking. I didn't speak. I was too preoccupied. It was strange hearing the name Scott Murdoch after so many years. Sometimes, in the worst moments of the secret life, when I was both judge and executioner, I wondered what had happened to that person. After a long silence, Bradley soldiered on.
"Following weeks of research, Harvard told me that Dr. Murdoch took a job at Rand. They knew because he was recruited on campus, and they found a record of it. But here was the strange part. Rand was certain it had never heard of him. So were the professional associations, licensing boards, and all the other organizations we contacted. As far as we could tell, when Dr. Scott Murdoch left Harvard, he walked off the face of the earth. Where did he go? We asked ourselves.
A chill, which had started at the base of my spine, was spreading fast. They had unearthed Scott Murdoch, and they knew that he had vanished. That was a fine piece of work, but not half as good, I suspected, as what was coming.
"We had an address for Scott Murdoch from his years at high school," Bradley continued. "So we headed out to Greenwich, Connecticut. I spoke to somebody through an intercom, told him it was the NYPD, and the gate swung open."
I looked up at him, wondering what he and Marcy, a couple struggling to get by in Manhattan, must have felt when they drove up the endless drive of my childhood home, past the ornamental lake and the stables, and stopped at what has been described as one of the 10 most beautiful houses in the country. Coincidentally, Bradley answered my question.
"We never knew houses like that existed in America," he said quietly.
The current owner, a well-known corporate raider, told them that both the elderly Murdochs were dead. "I heard they only had one kid," he said. "No, I have no idea what became of him. Must be loaded, that's all I can say." The next day, the two investigators searched the registry of deaths and found the entries for Bill and Grace.
"We even spoke to a few people who'd been at both funerals," Bradley said. "They all told us Scott wasn't at either one of them."
It was obvious from his tone he thought that was the strangest part of all, but I had no intention of telling him that I would have done everything possible to attend Bill's funeral, if only I had known about it. I think Bradley knew he had hit a nerve, but I figured he was a decent man because he didn't pursue it. Instead, he told me that, by then, they were confident Scott Murdoch was their man.
2 days later, we knew for sure.
Apparently, he and Marcy had sent my social security number, or at least the one I had at Caulfield Academy in Harvard, to Washington for extensive checking. They wanted to know where it was issued, had it ever been replaced, and a list of other details which might give a clue to Dr. Murdoch's whereabouts. When the answer came back, it was alarmingly brief. No such number had ever been issued. I sat in silence. Some back-office idiot in the division had screwed up monumentally. I knew instantly what had happened. Years ago, when I took on a new identity, ready to go into the field for the first time, a special team had eliminated my old name and history. They closed bank accounts, canceled credit cards, and expunged passports, sanitizing anything that would tie a covert agent back into his former identity. The agent was supposed to have drifted off overseas, like many young people do, and disappeared. One of the cleanup team, either overzealous or poorly supervised, must have decided it would be even more effective to eliminate my former Social Security number. They could have told Social Security I had died. They could have let the number lie fallow. They could have done 100 different things, but the one thing they should never have done was ask for it to be eliminated. That mistake led to the situation I was now facing. A kid in Connecticut had an identifying number that, according to the government now, had never been issued. You didn't have to be Bradley to work out something strange was going on.
I figured to have a Social Security number vanish into a black hole, it had to be done by the CIA or something like that, the cop said.
It confirmed what he had started to suspect. Although many details were altered in the book, the cases it dealt with were from the secret world. An evening which had started out as a pleasant rendezvous with a pliant doctor had turned into a disaster and was rapidly getting worse. The book had led Bradley to Scott Murdoch and convinced him that he was the same person as Jude Garrett. Now he knew what sort of work I did. But how bad was it really? I asked myself. Very bad, the agent to me replied. I figured this might be my last night in Paris. With no time to waste, I spoke to him with a quiet ruthlessness. Time short, Lieutenant. Answer me this. So you think Garrett is a spy, but the man could have been anywhere in the world. What made you look in Europe?
The school,
he said. The school? How the hell would Caulfield Academy know I had been stationed in Europe?
When we visited the campus, some of the faculty remembered him. Weird kid, they said. Refused to speak in class, but brilliant with languages, especially French and German. If he was working for some black government agency, I figured they wouldn't send him to South America, would they?
Maybe not, I answered, but there are 740 million people in Europe, and you end up in Paris? Come on, someone told you where to find him, didn't they? That was every agent's real nightmare. Betrayal, either accidental or deliberate, was what killed most of us. The cop stared, disgusted anyone would think that his abilities were so limited.
It was a damn lot harder than a tip-off.
He said that after months of searching for Scott Murdoch and convinced that the guy was working for an intelligence agency, he realized he had to look for him under a different name. If Murdoch was a U.S. covert agent, how would somebody like that enter a foreign country? He guessed that the best and safest method would be to assume the identity and job of a minor government employee, a junior trade analyst, a commercial attaché, or something similar. Because Bradley's father had worked in Washington, he knew all such appointments were recorded in a variety of obscure government publications. The announcements usually included information like education, age, professional history, zip codes, birth dates, and other seemingly unimportant details. Lying awake one night, he tried to imagine what it would be like to keep assuming new identities, under stress at every border, struggling to keep an endless list of lies straight in your head with never time to think, just to answer. He knew if it was him, even to have a chance, he would have to populate the fake identities with easily remembered facts. A phone number from childhood, a genuine birth date with the year changed, the real first names of parents.
"You get the drift,"
he said, as we sipped our coffee, a universe away from the razor wire at a checkpoint on the Bulgarian border, being questioned by some thug in a uniform, his breath reeking of cigarettes and last night's dinner, turning your documents over in his hand, throwing questions at you out of left field, alert for any hesitation, only too happy to make a hero of himself and call out to the unshaven Vopos that he didn't believe this American or Briton or Canadian or whatever you happen to be masquerading as at that time in that place on that day. Yeah, I got his drift, but I was too shaken to reply. Armed only with his intelligence, Bradley had divined exactly how covert agents entered a country and how they controlled the endless detail on which their lives might depend. In all honesty, I was finding it hard to remain angry with someone I was coming to admire so much. Bradley said he discussed his theory with Marcy, and they decided to experiment. From all the information they had compiled on Scott Murdoch's early life, they assembled a list of 20 minor facts. While she went to work, he spent the day at his computer downloading the last 10 years' editions of one of the publications which recorded government appointments, the Weekly Federal Register. One evening, he and Morsi entered the facts into a search robot and, hoping to find a match for any of them, turned it loose on the register's huge number of announcements. 36 hours later, they had 3 hits. One was the zip code of Greenwich, Connecticut, used by a man appointed as a U.S. delegate to the International Arts Council in Florence, and which may or may not have meant something. Another concerned a trade attaché who had played squash at Harvard, just like Scott Murdoch, and looked very promising, until they realized they were reading his obituary. The third was someone called Richard Gibson, a U.S. observer at a meeting of the World Meteorological Organization in Geneva. His mini-biography included a birth date the same as Scott Murdoch's and a summary of his education. His high school was given as Caulfield Academy.
We searched the alumni records, but nobody called Richard Gibson had ever been at Caulfield,
Bradley said quietly. It was a remarkable achievement. He and Marcy, starting with nothing more than the name of a tree in Connecticut, had found Richard Gibson, the cover I had used to enter Geneva for my chat with Marcus Boucher at Richelieu and C. The name Gibson was the proof of principle. Now they were certain that the method worked. They went at it full tilt. 3 weeks later, the system identified a minor official working at the U.S. Treasury who had gone to Romania for a conference. The name the man was using was Peter Campbell.
I called the Romanian finance department and found a guy who had helped organize the event. He had a copy of Peter Campbell's entry visa, including his passport details. A buddy at Homeland Security ran a check and found the same passport had been used to enter France. The French government said Campbell hadn't just entered the country, he had applied for residency in Paris. On his application, he said he was the manager of a hedge fund, so Marcy called the Securities and Exchange Commission. Nobody named Peter Campbell had ever held a securities trading license, and the hedge fund didn't exist.
I watched in silence as Bradley reached into his jacket, took out 2 pieces of paper, and laid them on the table. The first was a page from an old high school yearbook showing a photo of the 4 members of the Caulfield Academy squash team. One teenager stood apart, as if he played with the team but wasn't part of it. His face and name were circled. Scott Murdoch. The second piece of paper was a passport photograph attached to the French residency application in the name of Peter Campbell. There was no doubt that the 2 photos were of the same person. Me. I didn't say anything.
So, this is how I figure it,
Bradley said.
Scott Murdoch went to Caulfield Academy, studied at Harvard, and joined a government black program. He became a covert agent, used 100 different names, and one of them was Campbell.
I kept staring down at the yearbook photo, trying to recall the members of the squash team. One guy was called Dexter Corcoran. A big creep, everybody hated him. I remembered that. The others, even bigger assholes, I couldn't even remember who they were. Deliberate suppression, a psychologist would have called it.
Maybe Dr. Murdoch was thrown out of the secret world, or his soul just got tired of it, I don't know,
Bradley was saying.
But he entered France on Campbell's passport, wrote a book to pass on what he knew, and published it under the name of Jude Garrett, a dead FBI agent.
When I still didn't respond, he shrugged.
And so the 2 of us end up here.
Yes, and there was no doubt about it. It was a brilliant piece of work by Bradley and his wife, but, like I said, it was their discovery today, somebody else's tomorrow. There was only 1 thing left for me to do, so I stood up. It was time to start running. Chapter 10. Bradley caught up with me at the doors leading from the hotel's beautiful courtyard into the Grand Gallery, moving surprisingly fast given his limp. I had said a curt goodbye and headed out, but he managed to grab my arm before I knew he was following.
I have a favor to ask,
he said.
That's why Marcy and I came to Paris.
I shook my head. I've got to go, I said.
Listen, please.
He took a breath, struggling with what he was about to say. But I didn't give him a chance. I pushed his hand away and started to leave.
No,
he said, in that authoritative voice. I looked around and saw that people at the nearby tables were watching us. I didn't want to create a scene, and it gave him a moment.
Go down deep enough into darkness, and nothing's ever the same,
he said quietly.
Being injured made me think differently. About life, my relationship with Marcy and my work. Especially my work. If there was one positive,
I'd had enough. I'm sorry, I said. The injury must have been terrible, and I'm glad you came through okay, but there are things I've got to arrange. I didn't have time for a sob story or to hear reflections on life from a man I would never see again. I was getting out of Paris, running for cover and maybe my life, and I didn't have time to waste.
Just 1 minute, one more, he said.
After a beat, I sighed and nodded. I suppose I owed him some small courtesy for telling me how my former life could be laid bare so effectively. But I didn't bother moving, and everything about my body language told him the Wailing Wall was in Jerusalem and to just get it over with.
You never asked about how I got my injuries, and I want to thank you. Professionals usually don't, of course. Most of us have been in bad situations, so there's not much point in talking about it.
Yeah, enough about correct professional conduct. What do you want to ask me? I thought.
I told you I was trapped in a building. It was a little more than that. I was in the North Tower of the World Trade Center when it went down.
Chapter 11. Bradley kept talking, but to this day I have no idea what he said. Somehow we returned to our table, but I was too preoccupied with cursing my stupidity to listen. No wonder he had post-traumatic stress disorder. No wonder he had weeks in intensive care. No wonder he was suffering from survivor guilt. No wonder he needed an impossible investigative project to bring him back from the dead. Bradley had said he was holding some guy in the dark, listening to him die. Meanwhile, outside their concrete tomb, Lower Manhattan was on fire. And yet I was so smart, I'd worked out it was a gunshot wound to the hip, and another one that took out his lung. If that was the best I could do, it was probably a good thing that I had retired. I was shaken from my harsh self-appraisal by his voice. He'd taken his cell phone out and was asking me something.
Mind if I make a call? I want to check in with Marcy.
I nodded. He waited for her to answer, turned away, and said a few brief words I couldn't hear. As he hung up, he motioned for more coffee and pastries. I hoped he had a credit card with no limit.
I only mentioned September 11th, he said, because it's the basis for what I want to ask you.
Go on, I said softly, trying to make up for even thinking the poor mother should have gone to the Wailing Wall.
As part of my recovery, I finally went back to Ground Zero, to the spot where the North Tower had stood, he said. I looked at it for a long time. God, it was cold. And I finally realized that I was so damned angry, I had no hope of ever making a full recovery. But I wasn't angry at the hijackers. They were already dead, and it wasn't because of the injuries I had received. Come on, I was alive. I was angry about injustice, about the uncaring way the world works. I knew a lot of ordinary people had died that day, not because of fire or falling masonry, but because of their compassion. It was their desperate attempts to save other human beings, often total strangers, that had ended up costing them their own lives.
He took a sip of coffee, but I knew he didn't want it. He was buying time, trying to work out how best to go on. I just waited. To my mind, he'd earned the right to take as long as he needed.
Ever think about how many disabled people were working in the Twin Towers that day?
He asked finally.
No, it never crossed my mind either, he continued, not until just after the planes hit. Of course, if you were in a wheelchair, your problems were far worse than anyone's. It wasn't as if you could try to get out by elevator. That's one thing we all know, isn't it? Those signs are always warning us to use the stairs, but say you can't walk. If I ever get trapped in a burning building, Mr. Campbell, all I ask is that I can use my legs. Just an even chance to run or die. That's not asking much, is it?
an even chance.
There was a guy, he was working for a financial services company, who had listened to all the fire drills and knew where his evacuation chair was. Ever seen one of those? It's like an aluminum dining chair with long handles that stick out front and back so people can lift and carry you. He was a paraplegic, and I suppose he was proud he'd overcome his disability and had a job. Might have had a wife and kids too, you never know. September 11th was the first day of school, and a lot of people were late. It meant he was alone in his corner of the North Tower when the American Airlines plane hit. The impact jumped his wheelchair halfway across the room. Through the window, he saw a blast of flame arcing into the sky, and he knew he had to move fast or he was dead. He found his evacuation chair, balanced it on his lap, and headed for the emergency stairs. On the way, he got drenched. The sprinklers came on, and with it, the lights gave out. He got out into the elevator lobby, but there were no windows, so it was dark. It was the building maintenance guys who gave him a chance. A few years back, they had used glow-in-the-dark paint on the emergency doors so that in a disaster, people could still find them. God knows how many lives that decision saved that day. He propped open the door into Stairway A with his wheelchair and positioned his evacuation chair inside. He wasn't a strong guy, but he transferred himself across. Immobilized now, he sits in an emergency stairway inside a burning building and does the only thing he can. He waits. There are three emergency staircases in the North Tower. Two are 44 inches wide, the other is 56 inches. It's a big difference. In the wide one, two people can pass each other and it's not as tight on the turns. Those turns would be critical for anyone trying to carry what is really a stretcher with a seat. As you can imagine, fate being a bitch, the paraplegic guy is on one of the narrow staircases. All through the building, people are deciding which way to run, towards the ground or up to the roof for a helicopter rescue. Those that go up die. The door onto the roof is locked to prevent suicides. Stairway A is full of dust, smoke, people, and water. Like a fast-running stream, it pours down the steps from overworked sprinklers and busted pipes. But the guy in the evacuation chair doesn't call out, doesn't ask for help. He just waits. For a miracle, I guess. Bradley paused, thinking about miracles, I suppose. For a moment, as he started speaking again, there was a tremor in his voice, but he managed to control it. A long way below, some middle-aged, not very fit guy hears about the man in the chair and starts yelling. He wants volunteers to go back up with him and help carry him down. Three men step forward. Ordinary guys. They follow the middle-aged man up the stairs, pick up an end of the chair each, and choose the right way. They don't go up, they carry him down. Through the crush of people, the smoke, the water, and those corners that were too fucking tight.
He paused again.
They carried him down for 67 floors. And you know what they found when they got to the bottom? No way out. It had taken them so long that the collapse of the South Tower next door had destabilized its neighbor. Ahead of them was just fallen concrete. Behind them was the fire.
Bradley shrugged. I remained silent. What was there to say, even if I could trust my voice not to falter? Sorrow floats, was all I could think of.
They turned back, reached a door onto a mezzanine, and got into the lobby. A short time later, everything went to hell when the building crashed down. The wheelchair guy and two of the rescuers somehow made it to safety, but two of those who saved him didn't.
He paused for a moment.
You know what took their lives, Mr. Campbell?
Compassion, I said.
That's right, like I told you. It wasn't the falling masonry or the fire that killed them. It was their goddamned attempt to help somebody else. That was where my anger came from. Where was the justice in that?
He caught his breath for a moment before saying softly,
I wasn't sure I wanted to live in a world like that.
I knew then that Bradley had visited Ground Zero in more ways than one. I pictured him in the snow at dusk, a tiny figure in the acres of emptiness where the Twin Towers had once stood, doing his best to find a reason for living. Thankfully, Marcy was with him, and he said they held hands as he told her about his despair. So, what are you going to do about it? She wanted to know. Totally matter-of-fact. He told me he looked at her in confusion, no idea what she meant.
Yes, I've got it, Ben. You don't want to live in a world like that, she said. Okay, but as people say, are you going to curse the darkness or light a candle? So let me ask you again, what are you going to do about it?
That was Marcy. She had become so tough, she wasn't surrendering an inch anymore.
She was right, of course, Ben continued. Then we talked about what to do all the way home. Because of my injuries, I didn't know much about the 9/11 investigation, and as we walked uptown, I listened as she told me 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, how bin Laden's family were spirited out of the country in the aftermath, that most of the perpetrators were in America on expired visas, and several of them had learned to fly planes but hadn't shown any interest in landing them. It became clear that, even though the hijackers had made scores of mistakes, they were still better than us. And if anyone doubted it, there were 3,000 homicides on my turf that proved it. By the time we reached the village, I realized that an idea was taking shape. I worked on it through the night, and the following day, a Monday, I went to New York University and lit my candle. He said that, in a large office facing Washington Square, he explained to the college executives that he wanted to start an event that would become as famous in its way as the World Economic Forum in Davos. An annual series of lectures, seminars, and masterclasses for the world's leading investigators. A place where new ideas would be exposed and cutting-edge science displayed. He said it would be moderated by the top experts in their field, crossing all disciplines and agency boundaries. I pointed through the window, Bradley told me, to where the Twin Towers had stood. Men like that'll come again, I said, and next time they'll be better, smarter, stronger. We have to be too. All of us who are investigators have got one clear objective. We've got to beat them next time. There were 11 people in the room, and I figured I'd won over 3 of them, so I told the story of the guy in the wheelchair, and I reminded them that they were the closest college to Ground Zero. They had a special responsibility. If they weren't going to stage it, who would? By the end, half of them were ashamed, a few were in tears, and the vote in support was unanimous. Maybe next year I'll run for mayor.
He tried to laugh, but he couldn't find it in his heart. He said the arrangements for the World Investigative Forum were going better than he had expected, and he rattled off a list of names of those who had agreed to teach or attend. I nodded, genuinely impressed. He said,
"Yeah, it's all the big ones,"
and then looked at me.
"Except one."
He didn't give me a chance to reply.
"Your book has had a huge effect," he continued. "Being over here, you probably don't realize, but there's hardly an A-list profess—"
"That's why you came to Paris," I said. "To recruit me?"
"Partly. Of course, I came to finally solve the mystery of Jude Garrett, but now that I have, here's a chance for you to make a contribution. I know we can't say who you really are, so I thought you could be Garrett's longtime researcher, Dr. Watson to his Holmes. Someone who helped—"
"Shut up," I said. Something he probably wasn't used to hearing. I was staring at the table, and when I looked up, I spoke low enough to ensure it was for his ears only. "Right now," I said, "I'm going to break all the rules of my former profession. I'm going to tell you the truth about something. This is probably the only time you'll ever hear it from someone in my line of work, so listen carefully. You did a remarkable job in finding me. If I ever did another edition of the book, I would include your work for sure. It was brilliant." He sort of shrugged, flattered, I think, really proud, but too modest to express it. "You found a lot of names, unraveled a lot of cover stories, but you didn't find out anything about what I actually did for my country, did you?"
"That's true," Bradley replied. "I'm not sure I wanted to. I figured anything that secret was best left alone."
"You're right about that, so let me tell you. I arrested people, and those I couldn't arrest, I killed. At least 3 times I arrested them first, and then I killed them."
"Jesus," he whispered. "Our country does that?"
"I think homicide detectives and judges have a name for it, don't they? I can tell you, though, those sort of actions can weigh heavily on a man's spirit, especially as he gets older. One thing I can promise you, nobody could ever accuse me of discrimination. I was ecumenical in my work. I took down Catholics and Arabs, Protestants, atheists, and at least a few Jews. The only ones who seemed to miss out were the Zoroastrians. Believe me, I would have included them too if I knew exactly who they were. Trouble is, a lot of the people I hurt, their friends and family mostly, aren't active practitioners of what you and I might call Christian principles, Mr. Bradley. Specifically, they don't care too much for the bit about turning the other cheek. You know the Serbs? They're still angry about a battle they lost in 1389. Some people say the Croats and Albanians are worse. To people like that, a few decades hunting me wouldn't even count as a weekend. I'm telling you this so that you can understand. I came to Paris to live in anonymity. I've been trying to reach for normal. Tonight hasn't exactly been good news, so I won't be running any workshop. I'm running for my life. I got up and held out my hand. Goodbye, Mr. Bradley. He shook hands and this time made no attempt to stop me. The courtyard had emptied, and Bradley cut a forlorn figure sitting alone among the candles as I made my way out. Good luck, I called back. The seminar's a great idea. The country needs it. I turned to continue on my way and came face to face with a woman. She smiled.
I take it from the look on my husband's face, the answer was no.
It was Marcy. Bradley must have told her where we were when he phoned her. You're right, I said. I can't take part. He knows why.
Thank you for giving him the time, though, she responded quietly, for spending so long listening to him.
There was no resentment or anger. Her only concern seemed to be her husband's welfare. I liked her instantly. Bradley turned away from watching us and tried to attract the waiter's attention, calling for the bill.
You know, Ben admires you tremendously, Marcy said. I don't suppose he told you, but he read the book 3 times just for pleasure. He always says he wishes he could have done half the things you wrote about.
For a moment, I glimpsed a different Bradley. A top-flight investigator who believed he had never played in a league big enough to match his talent. More than most people, I knew that professional regret was a terrible thing to live with, and, as often happened, I started thinking about 2 little girls and what I did in Moscow a long time ago. Marcy had to touch my arm to break me out of the alley of my memories, and I saw she was handing me a business card.
It's our number in New York. If you ever get a chance, call him. I don't mean now, sometime in the future.
She saw my reluctance and smiled.
A few years would be fine.
But still I didn't take it.
He's a good man, she said seriously. The best I've known, better than most people could ever imagine. It would mean a lot to him.
Of course, I knew I would never call, but it seemed so unnecessarily hurtful not to take it that I nodded. As I was putting it in my pocket, Bradley turned back, and he and Marcy's eyes met for a moment across the silent courtyard. In that unguarded second, neither of them aware that I was watching, I saw them stripped of their social armor. They were no longer in Paris, nowhere near a 5-star hotel. I saw in their faces they were exactly where they had been before and after the North Tower fell. In love. They weren't kids, it certainly wasn't infatuation, and it was good to know that in a world full of trickery and deceit, something like that still existed. Maybe the evening hadn't been a complete bust after all. The moment passed. Marcy looked back at me, and I said goodbye. I went through the tall doors and paused at the lectern where the courtyard's maitre d' stood in judgment. He knew me well enough, and after I thanked him for his hospitality, I asked him to send the trolley over one more time and gave him 200 euro to cover the bill. I have no idea why I paid. Just stupid, I guess. Chapter 12. The American Airlines flight arrived in New York early in the morning. Towers of dark clouds hiding the city, rain and wild winds buffeting us all the way down. 2 hours outward bound from Paris, the fasten seatbelt sign had come on, and after that, conditions had deteriorated so rapidly that all in-flight service had been suspended. No food, no booze, no sleep. Things could only get better, I reasoned. I was traveling on a perfect copy of a Canadian diplomatic book, which not only explained my seat in first class, but allowed me to avoid any